I'm your inner dream monologue, and you're fast asleep, so I'll be quick. Great job using the Colgate Optic White Overnight Teeth Whitening Pen before bed. When used as directed, it gives you a visibly whiter smile in just 7 days. So while I fly and talk to animals, you're removing teeth stains with ease. Sweet dreams. And when you wake up, keep on living life to the brightest. Colgate Optic White. Find it at all major retailers.
Hey, I'm Brian Hyatt, and this is Rolling Stone Music Now. Now, we've had some legendary guests on this show, but today I think ranks pretty high. We have with us today Eddie and Brian Holland, who with Lamont Dozier made up one of the greatest songwriting teams ever to live. You know them as Holland Dozier Holland. These two brothers wrote an amazing new book called Come and Get These Memories about their days with Motown and a whole lot more. And I really enjoyed reading it, and I learned a lot. And I don't know if you guys can grasp the extent to, you know, I'm a little younger, so these songs were just graven in stone. They were always there for me. And to learn the humanity behind the writing of them was an extraordinary experience. So I guess I'll start, first of all, if you could introduce yourself so our listeners know which one is which.
Oh, I'm Eddie Holland.
I'm Brian Holland.
Welcome again. There's a lot in the fascinating memories of your childhoods and your family, and you know, I recommend everyone dig into the book and read about that, but we only have so much time, so I guess I'll jump ahead and just wonder if you could talk about your first encounters with Berry Gordy, which was pretty early on, obviously.
Well, I met Berry Gordy first. I was about 18 years old, you know, so that was a few years ago. And he was, you know, basically a struggling songwriter, and wrote some pretty good songs, you know, for, you know, Jackie Wilson, or two or three hits. And I think he had trouble getting his royalties collected from a New Yorker by the name of Nat Tarnopol. So it put him in a situation where a lot of us creative people are, you know, you're staying with family, depending on family to help and this and that. And that went on for a few years in his life. And till he just, you know, end up finding I would say the artist found him a singer, because to record his material. And he wasn't managing him. He was just doing it to make money. You know, I think they would charge $500 to get your songs recorded and get a recording of it. And one of the records were very, very exceptional and became very successful. That started the whole thing, the whole ball rolling. You know, they had enough money to buy Hitsfield. They lived in there upstairs and recorded, built a studio downstairs, and sort of opened the doors for the people that he knew and liked, you know, which was myself, Brian Holland again, and Eddie Holland, and Smokey Robinson, for, you know, and so, you know, we got together, and you know, he liked young people around anyway, you know. But for whatever reason, we started gravitating and start learning in such a fast pace how to write and produce ourselves, you know. Then he looked and he said we had surpassed him. And so he just stepped back, and for the most part, and let all of us, you know, do our thing, as he says. And he said that he was amazed how we developed. But it was when I say it was quickly, it wasn't really that quick. Not to us. You know, when you're young, you know, 18, 19 years old, 2 years is a long time. It's a lifetime point. To you. Know? So that's basically how, you know, it all started.
Now, Brian, I believe the first hit you were involved with was Please, Mr. Postman.
That's correct.
Maybe you can share just a little bit that was a co-write with a number of people, not with Eddie at that point.
No, that was with Robert Bateman and Georgia Dobbins and Freddie Gorman were some people that helped write that song, which it was unbelievable how that song lasts so long, and then the Beatles picked it up and they put it on their album, which sold more than everything. Any person I had been with had recorded that song with, you know. And I think... The Carpenters did the song also,
There was a couple other people that did the song too. What's so surprising also was that Postman went to number one on three different artists. You know, so that caused me to make a little money with it, you know.
Yeah. Now, as the story goes in the book, Eddie, when you saw some of the royalty statements for Please Mr. Postman, that's when you realized that maybe being a songwriter was better than being a singer.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, all you fledging artists and writers mm-hmm. who have experienced the same type of thing, you know, where it's not that easy for records to sort of take off and you go into your fortunes of glory and whatever. Sometimes it doesn't happen as quickly as you want. Mm-hmm. And but my brother, being the youngest, he was making what I considered a lot of money at that time. And I was impressed, and so that caused me, which I didn't really like performing anyway. I didn't like traveling around. It wasn't my type of style. It was my personality. I was a little more introverted. I really didn't like it, you know. Guy, and I've learned to appreciate artists who travel a lot. Who love it, especially Smokey. Smokey can travel forever, ever and ever. He loves it, you know. And it wasn't my thing. So I just took to songwriting. I learned how to learn to write, you know, because I thought I could be of a great asset to Brian and Lamont.
Yeah, I mean, the way it worked was, and I don't know if everyone knows this, is that Brian and Lamont were essentially the musical composers, and Eddie, you were the lyricist. Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah, you woodshedded for a number of months to learn. A
couple years.
Yeah, for a couple years to learn how to write lyrics from scratch.
Absolutely. I had no idea, no concept of it at all, you know. But, you know, I'm a quick study in things that I'm interested in, which is probably most people are. If you're really, really interested in something, you can be a pretty quick study, whoever you are, you know.
You had some pretty serious competition at Motown, given that the other main lyricist was Smokey Robinson.
Well, that was extreme competition, because I thought he was brilliant. I still think so. I know when he first started and the songs that he was recreating, he was barely a teenager. I didn't know how in the heck he could do it, how he come up with it. It was just amazing to me, because he was writing just like he was an old man, you know. He was hardly in his 20s, you know. And he just amazed me, you know, especially the things he did on, you know, Mary Wells, you know, and Beat Me to the Punch, and mm-hmm. I Got Two Lovers. I said, what the heck does this guy know about writing like that? Mm-hmm. But he was a natural poet, poet, you know, and extremely good.
But as Barry Gordy pointed out, you were and are a psychological writer. A different kind of approach to
right,
to
right. Yeah. Yeah, you heard that too. Yeah, yeah. That is true. That's true, because my first introduction in trying to learn, as I wrote down two of Smokey Robinson's songs, but I can't remember what they were at this point, and I studied it, and I realized he was so sophisticated. I said, it would take me a lifetime to write like this. I said, I have to find another approach to writing, you know.
Yeah.
And so I developed another technique, you know, based on, you know, trying to, for people to pick up the sound, to pick up the words, and I started quickly learning to, you start putting words in the same rhythmic pattern, and you put certain words on certain patterns of music, they seem to stick more. For some other reason, I was able to pick up on that, and I started developing a whole nother approach to it. And that's what Barry said. He said, you're really a psychological writer. Because I would always tell people, I've always criticized a lot of the writers. You can't understand what everybody said. You know what they mean. And I said, I'll tell you one thing. I said, maybe you can't hear every word I say. I said, but you cannot listen to a song and not know what it means. Because I had the words placed in such a way. And I used something what I had learned in high school called repeat formation, so that is saying the same thing but differently. But you keep the pattern straight. You keep to the point where people can pick up on it, you know. So yeah, it took a little time to develop. But I was glad I was able to do it. I was very fortunate too, you know. Went to great schools, by the way. Not that I did so well in the schools, because I really didn't. I really wanted to get in and out so fast, you know. But I realized that I had picked up enough that I was able to, you know, conjugate these words and different things, you know.
Well, what you guys did, and very quickly, was embark on one of the most extraordinary creative streaks in the history of American songwriting. I think it would be hard to deny. And I think one of the main things is amazing is the process, which is that Lamont and Brian would compose the song and then make a track. And you would have a melody that was kind of a dummy. It was just humming, right, with no words. Is that kind of and
right? No, yeah. As a rule, no words.
But,
no words.
But you would write to a finished track played by the Funk Brothers. You would actually sit there and write to that, which is, you may have been the first person to do that, because no one was set up to do like that before, you know.
Well, first of all, again, by me not really being a songwriter, just learning. And the thing that really inspired me is that I found out that my brother could really write great melodies. And I was just fascinated with his melodies. And I was also fascinated and asked myself, why could he do that? And I couldn't. How could he hear that? And I couldn't. So at very early age, I would think about that. You know, glad he could do it, but I would analyze everything anyway. So, but the fact of the matter is, once I heard the melody, I learned to take the melody along with the rhythm and just synchronize the words, you know. So I could do it pretty easy. But the thing about it is, I remember once Mickey Stevens, another great songwriter and producer, he once told me, he said, look, everybody's, you know, the executives that they're, you know, with the lawyers and administrators, they were sort of envious that the creative people could come in anytime they wanted to, although we didn't come in really, really late. We loved, you know, they had to be there at 9 o'clock in the morning. He said, well, these guys are making so much money and they're so young. He said, they come in when they want to. I think they should come in at 9 o'clock in the morning, like the lawyers in the ministry. I said, listen, I'll tell you something. I said, I'm not doing that, because the one thing I didn't want to do was push a clock, especially if it's something I didn't like doing. But I was just psychologically, I didn't want that pressure. I said, I tell you, he said, well, I'll get somebody else to write for Brian Lamont. I said, I tell you what, you can. I said, but not like me. He looked at me, because I was very, very serious, because I didn't think the way that I was writing and understood their melodies, I didn't think you could get somebody to do that easily.
I think you were right. Mm-hmm. Now, I mean, very early on, we're talking about 1963, you wrote Heat Wave. Mm-hmm. What do you remember about writing that one? Both of you.
Well, Lamont on that particular one was a great influence on the Heat Wave, you know, because Lamont was a master in doing shuffles. That was his main thing, shuffles, you know. So he would write this shuffle when he said, heat wave, heat wave. And so I just thought about it and thought about it. I think he had a couple lines of love is like a heat wave. And whatever. So I just took it for that and just created a song behind it. Because I always felt, you know, I learned early on that females bought most of the records. So I had a tendency to write what I thought appealed to females. You know, and that was a great gauge for me, you know, to write what would appeal to them.
Brian, it seems like you heard these arrangements in your head. You heard these chord changes in your head and just had to kind of get them out. Is that how it works?
Well, that's basically how it was. I could hear melodies quite frequently, and I would just go to the piano and just kind of bang it. I was never a real piano player, but I could play well enough to come up with the melodies and keep the melodies going. And I was so influenced by orchestration from school, from Ford Motor Company would sponsor kids to go to auditoriums, yeah, to see, hear these symphonic orchestras, you know.
Yeah.
And then when I went to see one, it was unbelievable. How they had all the strings and the horns and the timpanis and all together. I mean, it was just mind-blowing, you know, unbelievable sounds and whatnot, which influenced me greatly, you know.
But let me intervene in Bryant, which said, Bryant can't take all the credit now, because Bryant, unbeknownst at our early age, was gifted with the ear his grandfather had. Mm. His grandfather had, our grandfather really, had a super ear.
Yeah.
He, anything he heard, he could play. He was a trained, I don't know where he picked that up from, but he, if he heard it, he could play. Mm-hmm. He loved different sounds. Matter of fact, our grandfather would walk down the street with a, he would take a leaf off of a tree and he would put it in his hand. He would make all kinds of bird sounds. I always wanted to do it and never could do it. And he would laugh. He said, "No, you can't." He said, you're not going to be able to do that." But basically, Brian had his ear, he was gifted with it, and I wasn't, you know, and that. But that was just one of those things, you know. I guess we all have a separate talent. But again, I often thought about, wow, what a situation where Brian and I can pick up these talents from my parents and grandparents. You know, I had my mother's voice, tone qualities, and a person in school told me, say, "Look," he said, "you got this voice, you got a great sound in your voice." He said, "But you know what? You can't help it." He said, "Because you inherit that voice from somebody in your family, you know." But I often thought about how fortunate Brian and I were to learn and have all these things and to have an opportunity, you know, to do this. And they never could. I mean, they never could. Whatever their talents were, they could never make over $150 or $200 a week, you know. And here we are, we're doing the same thing that basically learned from them and could pick it up. And we could make thousands and thousands and thousands and millions of dollars from it, you know. And I often feel kind of guilty about that and said that they were shortchanged and whatever. I mean, well, again, that's my mind running away with being analytical, you know.
Sure. I mean, there were so many great artists as well, of course, at Motown at the time. You had the Supremes, and the Supremes were having trouble getting a hit. You needed to do a hit, and you came up with Where Did Our Love Go? Mm-hmm. What do you remember about that, Brian, or the musical?
Well, Where Did Our Love Go, once again, Lamont really came up with the actual melody to Where Did Our Love Go. And I remember that I wanted Dinah Ross to sing it, and Elwood wanted Mary Wilson to sing it, and so we had a little a disagreement there. So Elwood can tell you more detail about it.
Well, because when I heard the melody, I knew that it had a sensuous feel to the chords and movement, mm-hmm. you know. And Dinah Ross, when I heard her, she was always singing high.
Yeah.
And I thought her voice was high-pitched. And I said, this song here doesn't call for that type of melody and high with a high-pitched voice. And I said, "Brian," I said, "first of all," I said, "anybody could sing this song, you got a hit record." I said, "because it has a certain feeling. I could hear it. I could hear how I wanted to write it. And I knew that I could write it where it brought out the sensuousness in the melody. And I thought it was sort of sexy, you know." So, and Brian didn't like it. He didn't. I had to argue for a few minutes. And matter of fact, he thought I'd lost my mind, you know. And so I say, "well, okay, I tell you what, can we drop the key?" And Brian paused for a second or two. He said, "yeah, we could do that." I said, "okay, drop the key. I can get the same thing out of Dinah Ross." Because, I mean, I wasn't going to win that battle anyway. So that's how it worked out.
Yeah, you tell an amazing story about, in the book, about how Dinah wanted to kind of riff on it a little bit because she heard the way you were singing it. But then you basically told her, "no, she's got to sing it straight." She got pissed off. And then the take that we hear on the record, the vocal on one of the most famous songs of the 20th century, was done in this sort of like sarcastic, deadpan way. That wasn't supposed to be the vocal.
No, she was pissed with me. Right? That's the first time and only time, you know. And she said, "well, I'm going to call Barry," because, you know, at that time, you know, we were still young. Barry's the old man of the group, which he wasn't old. And so everybody was afraid of him, you know, but me, you know. And I said, "I tell you what, you can call Barry. That's my phone. You call, it's on the, you call him." I said, "but when you call him, tell him to come here and take you in the studio also." And I looked at her eyeball to eyeball, and she looked at me eyeball to eyeball, and she said, "this fool means it." So anyway, she started going. We went to the studio, you know, and my brother was the engineer, and she started singing, and she had the most deadpan look on her face, but her voice had this sensuous sound to it. It was just something about it. And I could hear the sound in her voice, and I knew what the words were saying, and I knew what the melody was saying to me, you know. And she kept that deadpan look on her face. And my brother looked at me by the engineer and said to say, "You want me to stop this? You want me to go on?" I said, "No, don't stop. Whatever you do, do not stop," you know. And so he kept it going, she kept it going. And when she got to the end of the song, she was even worse. "Is this what you like? This what you want?" I said, "That's exactly what I wanted."
And that's what we hear and on the record.
That's the record you hear. She's saying it right straight through.
And then, so that was a huge hit. And then you needed more hits for the Supremes. And then I cannot believe in 5 nights, you wrote 3 songs, Baby Love, Come See About Me, and Stop in the Name of Love, in 5 consecutive nights. Tell me about that. Because a lot of times what I see in the book is it was just like necessity was the mother of invention.
Kind of invention.
If you were pushed to do these things and you just did them. But it seems kind of miraculous to me.
But you know what? Me too, Brian. honest to goodness.
Yeah.
But what happened, I was standing outside. It was dark. It was short. I know it was in the evening time. And Berry Gordy had just left Barney Ailes, the salesperson, the guy who was responsible for a lot of the hits for us, because he's this great salesperson. And Barry was, and he looked up and saw me. He said, "Eddie," he said, "you know, I just left Barney." He said, and Barney said that what we had in the Supremes, they're more of a flagship company, because he's getting response from his record all over the world that he's never gotten before. And he said, "What we have to do is take advantage of them. We have to make these girls big. We have to make it successful." And I looked at him and I could see he was serious. I said, "Okay." And so when he didn't do a whole lot of talking, but I was glad he did say what he said to me. He knew that I was the kind of a person that if I had an idea of what the company wanted, I was always, you know, first in line to try to do and make money, you know, and he knew that about me, if nothing else. But I went upstairs, I told Brian, I said, "Brian, look, here's the situation. We got to get some songs on these girls." You know, Lamont was standing there and Brian was sitting at the piano. I said, "We've got to." I said, "We have to do it right away." I don't know how in the hell that Brian came up with all those melodies. I really don't know how he did it. But you know what? Creative binds is sometimes a strange kind of thing. It's almost like you don't control what's happening. If you feel that you have a need to do something, all of a sudden it's like another calling to you. You know, I don't know what it is. It's the same thing in writing. I never knew what was going to come out of me when I would try to put these words together, but I would sort of listen to the melody, listen to it over and over again until I almost got into somewhat of a hypnotic state, not knowing how to write. And I just wrote down everything that would come to me. Sometimes it was good, sometimes it was junk, you know. And I would take the good parts and I would start putting it together to form, almost like a puzzle, to form this feeling, this inspiration. That, and this is how I could put, you know, these songs together, you know. But whatever it was, it worked. We went into the studio that week, you know, not even a week, you know. And 1 3-hour session, we did all 3 of those songs.
It's incredible. And Brian, you were having a thing with Diana Ross at the time. And Baby Love was kind of inspired by that.
Well, kind of. But though I can't say she was directly cause of that, but I had a romantic relationship with her that could have been subconsciously causing me to write the melody and whatnot, you know, and several other melodies that I did when I was dating her. But, you know, who knows? Love.
Oh, I know. Brian, love. Let me tell you something. First of all, that is exactly what happened with Brian. He probably doesn't remember. But no. I know, see, Brian, he would get into these moods. especially if it was somebody he, you know, he's emotionally involved with, he was attracted to, and he would sit at the piano and start writing all these love songs. I said, this guy is always love, always that. You know, he's to get into those moods. And this baby love, I thought it was a horrible title. I said, I hope he doesn't want me to write something about baby love. It's baby love. You know, he gets it, you know what I mean? It's once again, those creative juices start working, it takes you into places psychologically that you don't necessarily plan to go. You just automatically find instinctually you're moving there. And that's what he would do all the time, you know, whatever it is, whether it was the song Bernadette. I said, oh my God, not a Bernadette. Oh my God. I said, I hope this is not what he wants me to write. And I had to sit and listen to the melody. He's Bernadette. And then I said, well, I love the way he's coming on with the melody. I said, but I sure hope he doesn't come with the title Bernadette. Sure enough. In love with a Bernadette. I said, oh my God, Brian, are you serious? He said, yeah. I said, I knew. I looked in his eyes. I said, okay, fine.
Now, Stop in the Name of Love, I mean, one of the extraordinary things about it, famously, of course, is it starts with the chorus. Mm-hmm. What do you remember about that decision to kick it off like that?
Well, I don't remember exactly why, other than I knew that I wanted a great intro. With the organ coming, then stop, you know what I mean, for a dynamic of a situation, you know. So that was one of the things that created that intro. I wanted a dynamic intro, you know what I mean.
Now, that title was one that Lamont came up with that Bryant liked. And my thing was, if Brian likes the title, I would stick with it because I figure I could make sense out of anything. Mm-hmm. I felt if I could make sense out of a baby love title, I could sure make sense out of that. So I would leave it as it is, mm-hmm. you know, because to me that was a big part of it. And but the only way I could write it and create it, I had to use my own experience. Like Lamont had an experience with the Stop in the Name of Love for his personal, I don't know, Defrey, because he was a kind of a little playboy type thing. And he would come up with the title, so that was good. But I didn't know about Lamont's experience. I can't live it. I couldn't walk in his shoes, but I could walk in my own shoes. So what I would do with that song, I just took my experiences that were fast, because I had two people that I was hooked into one relationship and had just met another person, that for the first time, I said, wow, this person is special, special, special. So, you know, and so I had to write about that. And then there was another girl that thought she liked me. So she went and told the first girl, yes, you know what, he's really interested in this girl up here. She's a secretary, and she works in that law office, you know. So she took her up there. Mm-hmm. to see her. So, and that's what caused all that to happen. So I just wrote about that. I was glad I was able to put those words together, because I didn't think I was that much of a wordsmith, to be honest with you. But it took me 3 weeks to put those things together. Smokey Robinson whips them out in a day or two, 3 days, you know, if he's in a good mood. Me, it took me 2-3 weeks. I don't care what kind of mood I was in, as a rule.
Now, Baby Don't You Do It is, you know, originally recorded by Marvin Gaye, but it's also became a rock and roll classic as well. I mean, there's a great version by The Band. There's a great version by The Who. Mm-hmm. I don't even know. The Who version is a little more obscure, but it's incredible. That's an underrated song. That's a fantastic song. What do you remember about writing that one?
Well, I'm going to tell you something. I don't know how in the heck I did. That didn't take me a long time to write that song, because to me, it reminded me of a gospel. You know, because Brian and I, we had to go to church, man. When we were coming up, we had to at least 4 or 5 times a week. I mean, really, it was kind of nerve-wracking sometimes, but you had to do it. But it was just a rhythm thing. Dun, 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 dun. I mean, I love the rhythm thing, you know. So it was easy, baby, baby, don't do it. Don't do it, baby. And then to go down to the river, that was all part of when you're sitting in church, to be honest with you, and they giving you this baptized. And I can remember when I was baptized, and I remember the minister splashing me down in the water and pulling me back up. So all of that, you know, Don't Break My Heart, that was the easy one, because I just tied all whatever that spiritual thing is, the gospel stuff that I picked up, and I just made it palatable to females, you know. Don't break my heart, blah, 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 blah. I never liked that song that much. I mean, I didn't think that much of it. It was just a track that did. And I don't know, I think we might have done it, did it for a B-side or something, you know. And I heard a few people really like it. I said, wow. You know, I was really, really very surprised. Years later, I had a better appreciation for it. You know, I mean, I love the way Marvin Gaye did it and the other records I heard.
I heard it by the Who or the band. I think it was the Who. On they did a video of it, and I saw it on TV, and I was shocked. They did a great job, too. You know what I mean? A great job. Baby, don't you do it. I said, wow, don't you break my heart. And then when they said, go down to the river, then there I'll be. I mean, I loved it. It was really, really good.
What do you remember about the music of that coming together? Because it is a groove thing more than
right.
more than most.
Right,
you know?
Right. Was well, we wanted to do some kind of R&B song at that time. Separate ourselves and do a little more R&B than the pop. That's what really happened. That's why we came up with that song.
Now, Nowhere to Run, Martha and the Vandellas, there's a bit of the times coming in, 1965, and there's a bit of Vietnam and everything else subtle, because you weren't... The idea was Barry wasn't too big on overt protest music, but it's slipping in there, right, with a song like that.
Well, not really. See, Lamont came up with that title, and for what I understand, he came with the title because of a person he knew that was going to the service. But see, when Lamont would come up with titles, he didn't necessarily, which he never did, tell me how and why he came up with it. He just felt it and came up with it. And when they cut the track, they gave me this track with the Nowhere to Run, Nowhere to Hide. So typically me, I had to write it from a female point of view. And this is what I did. Never knowing about Vietnam, the song being associated with someone in Vietnam. I had no idea. I wouldn't have written it like that way. I wouldn't have written it anyway. Not that way. Because I didn't feel comfortable writing about things I didn't know about. Or I had to write something I believe was appealing. Because I was writing for them to be a hit. I want to make money. That was my whole object of writing in the first place, to cause me want to write. I wanted to make money.
What do you remember about that one, Brian?
Nowhere to run, nowhere to hide. Well, I do remember that I went out in the studio, in the back of the studio. I went outside and got some chains. Used the chains on a bag beat, you know what I mean? Just to create a different kind of sound, you know what I mean? And I loved it. It was just a great song, great song. That's all I can remember.
Yeah, because Brian, you were also the main producer of
right,
these songs.
Right. So, although the engineer too.
Yeah.
I engineered all my songs.
They kept you busy, yeah.
Kept me busy. That's right. Running down, hooking up mics and whatnot.
Now, Barry was very aware of the low end, the bass. And that was, I think, you know, when Paul McCartney listened to Motown Records, that was the first thing he noticed.
Right.
It's just, the bass was much more present.
Right.
What was the trick there?
The trick was we used two basses. Well, James Jamerson, which was the greatest bass player I knew of, we used him and then another bass player also. I can't remember another guy's name, but we used two to get a real bass rumbling sound, you know what I mean, that people would feel, you know.
Was there an engineering trick as well?
Well, not a trick. But
or a technique, yeah.
It's a technique to balance them so where it would work, you know, not get too muddy, you know what I mean?
But you know what I noticed when Barry first started and he built the studio, he wasn't really an engineer in the first place. But he, you know, the equipment wasn't that sophisticated at that time. And the boy, we only had, what, 8 tracks or something, Brian?
Yeah.
8 tracks. You know? So Barry Gordy, for whatever reason, when he would go for bass, drums, and he had a tendency to push the bass up and the backbeat up. No one was really mixing like that, you know. He just felt putting that bass up because first of all, the bass movement was very, very strong because of the sophistication of the bass that we use. And then he would want the backbeat. That would give the drive. So he instinctively started doing that. And like I said, when nobody else was doing it, everybody else's records, you know, Capitol, RCA, and whatever, they were just this normal, what they call normal bass. They put the bass there and had it there, and you know. But see, to us, the bass and the backbeat was really the key. You know, nobody else was functioning like that. We were functioning at these records in a very strong, aggressive style. So he instinctively started doing that. So we instinctively started mixing that way. And if so-called, we looked around and they kept saying a Motown sound. And there, I remember when the studio, Barry said, guess what? I said, well, he said, you know, he said, we're trying to get the sound that they have in these major record companies. He said, I found out they trying to get our sound. I said, are you serious? He said, yeah, can you imagine that? They trying to get our sound. And I mean, that was mind-blowing to me because our equipment wasn't that sophisticated.
Yeah.
But we had good, solid equipment, you know, what it was. But we took the most out of it by making it dominant and creating that rhythm thing. So it just created the whole part. I think it was responsible for that so-called Motown sound because none of the musicians, the producers and writers, they didn't produce and write alike. But the sound was in common.
Unified it, yes.
Yeah,
yes,
but the sound of that was common. Same studio, same musicians. And it was mixed the same way because Brian was doing a lot of other mixing.
Now, something happened with the Supremes, I Hear a Symphony, where I think you had to pull an all-nighter writing the lyrics to that.
Oh, man. When I wake up screaming now thinking about that. My brother called me. I was in for the night. And he said, I did this song, I Hear a Symphony. He said, and I played for Barry. And he said, man, he said, the Supremes are leaving town in the morning. I'd like for him to do this song. I said, and I'm waiting for him. I said, I know he's not telling me what I think he's saying.
Wake up.
I said, wait a minute. I said, when do you have to have it? He got to have it in the morning. I couldn't believe my eyes. I'm the kind of guy that takes 2 and 3 weeks at least to do a song. He said he has to have it in the morning. And oh my goodness. So I started working on that song. I was so tired, I could hardly hold my eyes open because I was not really a night person per se, you know. Even since when I was a kid, I couldn't stay up really, really late at night, although I would try to, but I couldn't. And so I was so tired. It was like 12 o'clock. I was really beat then, really beat. And I said, I'm going to have to call Brian. I said, I'm going to have to tell him that I can't do it. There's no way I can do it. And I went to pick the phone up, and I felt so badly. I said, I don't want to disappoint him. So I put the phone back down, and I worked on it again. By the time it was 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock, I said, I went back to the phone again. I said, I just can't do this. I can't get through it. I can't hardly keep my eyes open, let think, you know. And I said, I just can't make this. So I, once again, declined from calling him. And I just worked with that song all day, morning time coming, and early morning. And I was still working on this song. And I said, on the way to the studio, I was still working on this song. Diana Ross was in the studio. I'm getting ready to rehearse her, not in the studio, but the office, my office. I said, and I'm still working on this song. And man, it was so miserable. And I said to myself, I don't care. I will never do this again. I don't care what the situation is. So that was a bad, bad time for me. Horrible
time.
Yeah,
but he would do it though.
Oh, no.
He said that.
Oh, no. He said that. I couldn't go through that stuff.
Brian, don't believe him.
In the break, you guys were talking about the groove that James Jamerson got in Nowhere to Run. What were you saying?
Wow, I loved it. Listen, He had that boom, 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 boom. And then I had another bass doing boom, 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 boom. And then Jamerson, he was so funny. He would always take his leg up and stomp down, boom, 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 boom. Like he's really into it, you know what I mean? Well, that's what he played his bass anyway. He was always into it, just stomping his feet, you know what I mean? But he was one of the greatest bass players ever. Matter of fact, has been in many, many bass players trying to emulate.
Oh, sure.
James Jamerson, you know. Right today, the guys tell me, say, man, I hear that James Jamerson, man, and I, I just can't. He only played with one finger, you know.
Yeah.
Isn't that amazing? When you think about it, that is really crazy.
Now, Reach Out, I'll Be There, that is one dramatic, wild song. Brian, the drama of that song, how did that come about?
Well, I can't speak about the drama of it. I know that.
Well, you know, it's all, you know, just reach out, like all it's so dramatic. It's so
dramatic, that kind of thing. Yeah, reach out, okay, right. I don't know. We was in working on a song in the office, and reach out, I'll be there. I don't. Maybe you can explain.
I was sitting there, but you're right what you said. But see, once again, that's when creative people. I don't know what happens to all of us or something, you know. You get hit by this inspiring situation.
In the moment.
You know
what I mean? Right.
You're not planning it, you know. You're not even thinking about it, you know. You just, it's like euphoric. You just, boom, you hit it. And that's what Brian did. Mm. He hit that chord part, you know, and it was sounding really, really strong. To me, it sounded symphonic-like, a symphonic type of thing, you know. And what happened, Lamont was standing up there by him, and Lamont all of a sudden...
You got the feeling.
He pushed Brian out of the way. First of all, I was insulted. I said, this guy crazy, is he crazy? Because the way Lamont violently almost is what I... It just pushed him out of the way and went to the dump, you know what I mean? Went to that middle part, you know? And he got caught up in the feeling of it also. And that's why he pushed Brian out of the way, because he had the feeling, you know? And he just wanted to get it before he lost it, you know? But like I said, when he said that, when he pushed Brian out of the way, he
shoved him out of the way, yeah.
Yeah, he did. He shoved him out of the way. And I never will forget it. Like it was yesterday. I said, man, this guy, is he crazy? You know, because I was a fan. I don't know what the heck was going on. So that is what created that thing, you know. But then all I had to do was write it. That would have been the easy part.
I mean, so that would be like when it was given to you to write lyrics, because it's hard for me to imagine that without the lyrics. So was it just like, dun-dun, dun-dun-dun, you know what I mean? Is that how you had it?
Oh, yeah. The part, the dun-dun, dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun. Oh, yeah, that was a symphonic part of it.
That's how it hit everybody.
Yeah. If you slowed it down and played it, dun-dun-dun, it would be very symphonic, you know what I mean? Like a orchestral type of thing, you know.
So you would just, would you record a scratch vocal that was like humming for these songs? You know, you know what I mean? What was expressing the melody for that he wrote to?
No.
My one talent,
right.
I could remember melodies.
Right.
Gotcha.
I could hear it and I remembered them.
Right.
So, and I could retain the feeling of it.
So there'd be no vocal. Got it.
Yeah.
What an amazing process, though.
Yeah.
The last thing I asked you is, you point out that at Motown, it was basically more important to have a hit song than even a good song, although God knows you had a lot of good songs. Well, but that commercial... Yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
No, Brian, I was going to say, it was more important to have a hit song than a girlfriend at that time.
Well, one comes with the other, I guess.
Well, it came after, for sure.
But Barry was very... he was tough on... He got the sound a certain way. He was very lyric conscious, song conscious, very, very much so. So that always put us on the, you know, pushing for something, you know, because he was very, very conscious of, because then he was a songwriter. See, the type of things that we were doing, he couldn't do that anyway. He never felt that, never heard that. But a song, he always heard a song, the lyric, the melody, you know. It just so happened Bryant was so good at what he was doing, you know, and Barry thought it was very unique. And then when I started writing the song, he was really, really impressed, because he would always say that other people, he could never hardly hear songs that were always right, nothing wrong with it. He said, and he could understand why I could do that, because after the first two or three, you know, I remember in the studio, he said, Eddie, he said, you keep writing like this, I'm going to think you're better than me. And I said, Barry, I am better than you. He said, what did you say? I said, I am better than you. And he got very, very quiet, you know, because he was always sensitive about his creativity in the first place. But coming from me, he tolerated, he, you know. But the fact is, that's what I believe. I believe I was better than him. I wasn't being, you know, that's the way it was, you know.
Well, Brian and Eddie Holland, thank you so much for being here. That was amazing. We could have talked for a whole lot more. Check out their book, Come and Get These Memories. And that is our show for today. We'll be back next week here on SiriusXM's Volume, Channel 106. In the meantime, we are a podcast. Download us as a podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Maybe leave a nice review for Rolling Stone Music Now on iTunes. But as always, thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.